at session number 30388, reel 9.
Have you reached the end of your tether there? Huh?
No, carry on. Thanks.
Right. We took them to the local railway station to go home and put them on the train after spending half an hour on the platform standing there, kissing them by turn, waiting for the train was going round and round. And we all had a skidful and were a bit pretty merry and made our way back in what we hoped in the darkness of Dover was in the direction of the docks. And as nature will have it, we had to make a pit stop. And we stood up against the wall, the four of us, in the middle of the night, relieving ourselves, and suddenly a voice behind us shouted, "You're under arrest!" And there was a copper on a bike. He'd come by with a small torch and he saw us standing there. So we all took off and ran like mad down the road, and he was following on his bike. We all fell down a shell crater in the road, which he knew was there, and he circumvented it. So we were in the bottom of this, and he went past. We eventually made it back to the ship, still slightly under the weather, and somewhat dirty from this shell crater. And when we reached the gangway, the sentry stood at the top and said, "Halt, who goes there?" And the proper answer is, "Halt, who goes there, friend or foe?" You see, and the answer is friend. And then he'd say, "Come up, step forward, friend, be recognized, one by one." They have a rifle at the ready. So when he called that out, we all shouted back, "Foe! Don't be silly! Foe!" So in the end, he let us on board. He was very put out. He said, "I could have shot the lot of you." But nothing further happened as a result of that incident. We then had an occasion when Antwerp was liberated. This was one of the high points of my naval career. Antwerp was liberated, and HMS Holderness was one of the vessels escorting the first convoy into liberated Antwerp, some 2 weeks after the Germans had left. It was a supply convoy which included a tanker, or two tankers even, I can't remember, and we were on full alert virtually all the way there, because action station, because this was very important, supplies for the troops. As we were sailing in the morning, we'd sail in the evening, as we were approaching that way, and I was looking on the clear, through a clear sky, and saw these things going across from horizon to horizon. I realized these were V2s heading towards London. And not very long afterwards, at a distance, there was a thump, and I looked up, and I saw that where a ship had been, there was now a cloud of fire and smoke and nothing else. And it rather brought home to me how life hangs by a thread, because that was a tanker that went up, and I don't think the people on board survived. We weren't allowed to stop anyway. We got to Antwerp, and we made fast alongside. They'd cleared as much as they could at the time of the anchorage and harbour there, and the skipper allowed some of us, on strict instruction, being back by midnight, to go ashore for a few hours. So we went into a dockside bar, three of us, I think we were, and, you know, brandy, oh, yeah. So, oh, no, you don't, no paying. I spoke a little bit of French, so I could tell them what we wanted. So, no, it's on the house sort of thing. Then we took a tram into the center of Antwerp, and the conductor, no, you don't take any money. And all the women on board came to give us a kiss and a hug, and victoire, and, you know, vive la France, vive l'Angleterre, and all this business. Eventually got to the center of Antwerp. What should we do? We had a pound's worth of local currency each. And we spotted a street, not far, somewhere near the center, fairly dingy street, but had quite a few buildings that had got pale pink or pale blue lamps outside their front doors. And I immediately twigged what these stood for. They were obviously houses of pleasure. So we walked up and down the street looking at a place that looked sort of a bit respectable, and marched in. True enough, came up the steps, through the door, into a corridor, door on the left, a madam sitting behind a desk, and a minimal charge, something like 10p entrance fee. And there were booths and chairs and tables and benches and whatnot, and girls were circulating round, and the place was full of troops. There were also a couple of Americans in there, although there was a big sign outside, these premises are off limits to American troops. So we went and ordered a couple of bottles of wine or something like that, which was another 10p each or so. And of course we sat down for a drink to take in the scenery and see what's going on here. When the girls come up, they've never seen British sailors, came up to us, and who's that? Chatting away as best I could in my schoolboy French. And, we want to go upstairs. We were joined by one lady who was a little bit older than most of them there. And she happened to squeeze in next to me. And spoke to me in French and said, how long are you staying? I said, we're going home tonight. Going back tonight, we're on duty. He said, oh, she said, you like to come upstairs with me. And I said, listen, you are not French or Belgian. Your accent is Roman. Where are you from? I'm from Austria. What? Yes, I was a comfort woman for the German army. And when they retreated 2 weeks ago, they left me behind. They abandoned me, so I got a job here. Of course, by that time, I was talking fluent German to her. We were having a long conversation. Suddenly, somebody taps me on the shoulder, and there's a sergeant sitting in the next one. I say, you speak their lingo? I said, yes. So can you fix me up with her? Sure. I told her, this can't, what's your services? She grabbed hold of him, went to the madam, he paid his money, went up, came back 10, 15 minutes later, came up to me, she's a bit of all right, she said, we'll have a go with her. Thank you very much. I spent the whole evening in that brothel translating for assorted troops and never had so much as a nibble myself because I couldn't afford it anymore. The charge was £1 and we'd all spend part of our pound and nobody was prepared to pool his money with somebody else. It was quite an experience. I spent about 3 hours doing that. I must have fixed up about 30, 40 blokes. And I also came across a funny one there, because to the Americans it was off limits. And as I said, there were a couple of Americans in there, and one of these had disappeared upstairs, and suddenly, I had to go to the pissoir, which was under the stairs. It was proper urinal there. And I heard a terrific kerfuffle going on upstairs, clumping of boots and shouting and whatnot in American accents, and then I could hear the ta-ta-ta-ta-ta of boots coming down the stairs at a rate of knots, and see this American looking around, see this American soldier desperately pulling his trousers up, rushing down the stairs with two military policemen on his tail. Well, he beat them to the door and he slammed it in their faces, whether he kept it closed from the outside till he got himself organized, I don't know, but he got away. It was quite funny. Anyway, we got back on board ship and we carried on, and the following morning we left with the unloaded ships and brought them back home. There is another incident worth of note. We were returning from a patrol or a convoy duty, but we were somewhere. No. We must have been crossed with a convoy to France. That was sort of in the later stages of the war, before the ports had been liberated. In other words, before the king. This is out of context, actually. Pardon me. We were on patrol. That's right. off one of the French ports. I think even it was Dieppe. And it was midnight, and nothing was happening. All was quiet. When suddenly we could hear aircraft, when we knew they'd be ours, because the Germans weren't flying about in those days anymore, not so much anyhow. And our radar picked up a contact fairly close to us. It was dark. In fact, it was very close to us, and it was a small contact. So the skipper put the searchlight on this contact, and it was a small trawler-type vessel flying the German flag. So immediately we put the searchlight on them. They started to sort of try to evade us, and we let fly with our small armament. So they hove to, and she sank. She was beginning to sink. We could see her settling in the ground. They obviously opened the sea cocks. And then the crew, about 10 of them, came overboard on a raft. I was summoned on deck because we'd obviously caught a German blockade runner. We were blockading the channel, the ports, and he was trying to sneak some food in from Germany to these beleaguered garrisons. I was called on deck to assist with the capture of the people, because the skipper, who hoped to board the vessel and tow it to Dover, realized that wasn't possible. She was settling in. We let scrambling nets down the side for them, and I was told the last man, I was told that they must not tie their life raft to the scrambling nets, because sometimes these things carried underneath them an explosive device designed to go off after a certain amount of time and do some damage to the rescuing ship. So they're not to make fast, they're just to hold on. And when the last man comes on board, he's to push the thing away with his feet as far as he can away from the ship's side, otherwise he won't be allowed on board. So they scrambled out wet and weary. One chap was injured slightly, had a shrapnel wound. And the last man to come was a very cocky young man who stepped up on deck and jumped to attention, "Heil Hitler!" And one of our junior officers, he saw red when he saw it. He grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and slung him overboard in the sea and said to me, "Headache, will you please tell this gentleman if he wants to come aboard the ship, he's to keep his mouth shut and do as he's told, otherwise he can swim home." And this fellow was floundering about in the water, and I told him exactly that in no uncertain term in his own language. He scrambled back on board and shut up. We shut him away. He was the in charge of the boat. We shut him away in a two locker on his own. His mates we all had in a different area. They all claimed, of course, that they were communists and had been forced to do this, and they were against Hitler and all this nonsense, all of which we took with a great big pinch of salt. But one of them thanked me for allowing them to come aboard, and they said, "Look, can I give you this?" And he gave me a beautiful life belt. It really was miles better than anything we had as a present, which he'd worn that and so on. And when we disembarked these guys in Dover, they were handed over to a major naval patrol. The officer in charge spotted this life belt, and he said, "That's a German life belt, isn't it?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Where'd you get it from?" I said, "One of the chaps gave it to me as a thank you for rescuing them." "Thank you. I'll take that in. All German property has to be handed in like hell." Like hell, if you know what I mean. He was looking after number one. So I lost my nice life belt. Not that I needed it, thank goodness. Do you want? I should mention that in the 21st destroyer flotilla, we also had a Polish destroyer known as the Szlądlak, which sometimes was tied up alongside us. Sometimes you had two destroyers swinging off one buoy. And that was always good fun because, apart from the vodka they had instead of rum, their food was a little bit better than ours. And we, unfortunately, none of them spoke any English. We also came across one of the 50 American destroyers which were bought by the government in exchange for leasing the base in Bermuda, I think, isn't it? And these were the most horrible looking ships ever. They looked so top heavy that I'm sure that in a Force 8, Force 9 gale, they'd have turned turtle with no problem whatsoever. And we came across them, but the Americans, they had the most luxurious accommodation compared to ours. If we weren't sleeping in hammocks, we were sleeping on the benches on which we normally sat in the mess, because there was no room for anything else, and if not that, it was on the deck. One day we took a convoy up to Grimsby, and we got stuck there because it was foul weather, and that was actually when I intercepted the Germans arranging to have a night out because they weren't going to sea. We were having a night out. There was a show in Grimsby called Venus Comes to Town, which was a so-called nude show. In those days, a nude show meant ladies in body stockings or whatever. They were posing without moving. So we went to see Venus Comes to Town and asked for seats in the front row centre, which of course we didn't get. But we were sitting there and we were all sort of fascinating. Our eyeballs were sticking about a mile outside our heads. When I felt uncomfortable, you know, and I realised suddenly that the chap sitting next to me, one of my shipmates, was sitting there with a cigarette in his left hand and burnt a hole into my best pair of trousers, causing a great blister to appear. And I hadn't noticed this because I was so fascinated by this so-called new display. On another occasion, we were made fast in Grimsby, waiting to go out in the evening, and we were hanging along the dockside. So the skipper decided we should hold an intership tug-of-war competition on the dockside. Now, the dockside where we were moored consists of wooden boards, thick slats, with gaps in between, which was ideal for wedging your foot in when doing a tug of war. For I don't know what reason, they made me anchorman of my mess team. And we had various pulls against other teams, and we were successful, until in the end we found ourselves in the final, needless to say, against the wardroom. And in the afternoon, sort of the final took place. Everyone was pretty exhausted already, but the officers couldn't afford to let the men win. And we had quite a good tussle, actually. They managed in the first pull to get us over the line. And we managed with great difficulty to get them over the line in the second pull. And everybody was braced for this third pull that was going to be decided. We're going to show these officers who's boss. And just as, you know, things were getting quite crucial and the pressure became too much, my right knee collapsed inward. And in excruciating pain, I had to let go and we were pulled over the line. The doctor had a good look at me and I thought, oh, I'm going to have a few days in my hammock now. He said, right. He said, I'm going to bandage you up. And he gave me some painkillers and bandaged me up. And he said, right, you'll spend the rest of the day going up and down the ladders and going and walking all over the ship. I don't want to see you sitting down or anything. You have to keep mobile, otherwise it might be serious. The long and short of it was that I had a most uncomfortable few days, but it sorted itself out. I also found myself in Naval Hospital in Sheerness on one occasion. Well, that was strange. I suddenly developed a swelling in my groin. I was rather worried about it, but it was quite painful. And so saw the doctor, and you've got an infection. Let's have a look at the sole of your foot, your right foot. So what have you been doing? He said. One of the nails from your shoe has gone through into your foot and you didn't notice. I said, no, sir. Oh, he said, well, you've got quite an infection. You've got to go to hospital with this. So I was transported into the Naval Dockyard Hospital in Sheerness and put in a ward with about 30 other people with one illness or another. Right at the beginning, the doctor came round, looked at me, and said, oh, there's nothing serious, we'll sort that out. Said, a couple of poultices will see that off, and so on. And gave me lots to drink and painkillers, and the matron walked into the ward half an hour later and said, who is the man with the swelling? So, big guffaw of laughter. Hard-bitten old matron. So eventually I tumbled to it and I said, I think I am matron. So she came up to my bed and she put a screen round my bed. And of course the remarks from outside, you can imagine. And she said, right, come on, take your trousers off, or shorts off, or whatever. I don't think I was wearing it. I was wearing a hospital nightgown. Take your nightgown off, or pull it up. Right, spread over, spread them out, your legs. You slap this hot poultice in there. It went through the ceiling. It was absolutely burning. Terrible. And of course, the boys were making remarks outside. I was in agony. But I had to keep it there. Strict instructions. And she disappeared, saying it would be renewed that evening. In the evening, we had a night sister, a night nurse, a staff nurse, and she was rather a good-looking girl and young, not like hard-bitten old matron. She knew who had the swelling, and of course, when she came in and put the screen round my bed, the remarks from the others were absolutely unbelievable. Typical lower deck stuff. And with lots of emphatic referrals to swellings and so on, as a result of which I had to sort of keep my mind very pure and clean so as not to upset the girl. But anyway, it all helped. I had 3 days in there. They were quite a funny old crowd there. I think most of them weren't really very ill. One bloke claimed to have been wounded, but all the others had one sort of illness or another. And we amused ourselves in the evening by looking out of the window into the street out. We were on the border of the dockyard, into the street outside the dockyard, looking into bedroom windows to see if we could see anything. Not that there was, because blackouts were on. That was another one of my funny little experiences. But anyway, I think I'll take you to the end of the war now.
Pause there for a moment. Yep. When you left Southmead, yep, did you have any choice as to what type of ship you'd be joining?
I was told you've been assigned to the HMS Holderness. You didn't have any choice.
Were you given any sort of training or instruction in survival in the sea in the event of sinking?
Well, I mentioned earlier, last week to you, that we had this swimming instruction. You remember in Wetherby, when I was in Wetherby? I had to wear a duck suit, the thing that pulled you down. I imagine that was intended to be, you know, so a sort of survival training, but no other things were taught us. We were assigned to particular stations in case of having to abandon ship. You knew where you had to be, and you knew what lifeboat or raft you were on, and that was it. People usually use their common sense. You know, I didn't have any experience like that, so I should imagine most people acted rationally.
And using the VHF radios, you mentioned it was only transmitted over the short range.
The transmission is only audible in the short range at sea level.
Were you able to tell what direction the source was coming?
No. We did have originally, these sets were supplied with a direction finding mast which was fitted to the ship. But it was generally considered that these were so inaccurate that almost in the week that I joined the ship, the one on my ship was dismantled, because by that time radar was fairly proficient in picking up what was coming from where, and they had about the same range as we did, but one had no means of telling where it came from.
During times of action, what would be your state of mind?
I'd be concentrating on my work. You've just reminded me of a most important incident that I haven't told you about. My state of mind was totally focused on my work. You don't have time to think about what might happen to you or to your ship or your shipmates. If you do that, you're no use to anybody. No, you concentrate on what you're doing. And I